I'm Robin Lustig, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. When did you last scribble a few lines on the back of a postcard? When you were on vacation, maybe, or a business trip? Having a lovely time, wish you were here. Thinking of you, missing you, back soon. Hardly the stuff of literary inspiration, you might think. But turn the clock back nearly 100 years, and you will find postcards with messages that can inspire. And they did inspire the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Robert Olin Butler to create a series of short stories based on the words that he found on the backs of old postcards. The collection is called Had a Good Time, Stories from American Postcards. And the stories range from a woman considering the impending death of her husband from tuberculosis to the thoughts of a freed slave about his former employers and an account of the fatal crash at an air show of the pioneer aviator Earl Sand. Poignant, sad, revealing. The stories seem to unwrap from just a few words a whole lifetime of experience. We want to hear your postcard memories this hour, postcards that you've sent, postcards that you've received. In this age of emails and text messages, are we losing the opportunity to leave something of ourselves behind for future generations to puzzle over? 1-800-423-8255 is our number. 1-800-423-TALK. Robert Olin Butler joins us now from Tallahassee, Florida. Robert, thanks for being with us on The Connection today.
It's a pleasure, Robin.
I want to ask you first of all about this thing between you and postcards. When did it start? Why did it start?
Oh, it's been more than a decade ago that I've began collecting these things. I guess I'm a collector at heart. And I first became interested in such paper ephemera from the early 20th century and late 19th century as trade cards and advertising cards. And I have an extensive collection of British cigarette cards, too. But eventually, I was hanging around antique malls and paper shows sufficiently that I started looking at the postcards. And very quickly, the thing that struck me was not so much the images on the front, but the messages written on the backs. And particularly in my book, the cards that I've chosen to do stories from are all from the 1906 to 1917. And in that period before phones were common, people would occasionally just pour their hearts out on the backs of these postcards. And so I saw these little bits of 10, 20, 30 subtext-rich words there that that spoke of some very complex feelings going on beneath the surface of people who had, you know, long since passed from the earth, but
can
whose emotions remain.
Can you remember one of the first postcards that you saw which had words on it which made you begin to think that maybe there was something more interesting here? Excuse me. More interesting than just, you know, having a lovely time.
Absolutely. One of the very first ones was actually of quite a different tone. The ones you mentioned at the top of the show are all some of the more poignant and darker cards, but there are some very funny ones too. For example, a very early one was from a guy named Milton who wrote to a woman that I take to be his sister, Matilda, up in San Francisco, and Milton is down in Sunnyvale, California, and it's dated July 14th, 1911. He says, "Dear Matilda, just a line to let you know I am still alive. I am not going on that hayride. The young man that wants me to go with his sister-in-law, but she has a cork leg. I'm awful tired. That is the main reason, regards to all Milton." So Milton didn't want to go with the girl with the wooden leg, but in the story he relents, and I think he's glad he did.
Let's look at another one of the stories that you developed from a picture. I want to give people an idea of how you do this. The one I've chosen is it's a picture showing a man walking down a street. He's walking away from the camera. It's a street. We see some Spanish writing on the wall of a house. There's a group of people further away, and there's a little arrow pointing at one of them. And just in the foreground of the picture, there are two guys lying on the street. It's not quite clear if they're asleep or if maybe they're dead. And on the back of the card, you see the words, "After the battle, notice the pretty señoritas in this photo, the one in white does my laundry." Now, there's not much there to give anybody any clue about what's going on, even where this picture was taken. Just read us a little bit from your story.
Okay. And as a matter of fact, I looked at that image with magnifying glass closely And it's quite clear they're not sleeping. There are pools of blood underneath those bodies. And this is a fragment from that story. "It's me, all right. Bunky snapping from behind, and I'm walking along one of the streets just off the Plaza de Armas, and there's been a gun battle. Bunky had it printed up on a postcard back for me, and I sent it off to Clyde. I've inked an arrow pointing at a tiny, unrecognizable figure way up the street, standing with a bunch of other locals. In the foreground, I'm striding past a leather goods shop. The pavement's wide and glaring from the sun. Even from behind, I've got the look of a war correspondent. There, but not there, unafraid of the battle and floating just a little above it all. Not in the manner of Richard Harding Davis, who came down for a syndicate after the action got started and who wore evening clothes every night at his table in the Portales. Not like Jack London, either, who was in Veracruz looking as if he'd hopped a freight from the Klondike. I've got a razor press in my dark trousers, and my white shirt is fresh. We boys of the Fourth Estate love our image and our woodchopper's feel for words. It's an image you'd like your editors to have of you, and so I sent this card, even though by the time I did, I'd learned a thing or two I couldn't put in a story for the Tribune or anybody else. I pull the card off the wall now and turn it over. I've scrawled in pencil, after the battle, notice the pretty senoritas in this photo. The one in white does my laundry. I draw my thumb over the words, compulsively noticing the dangle of the first phrase, which was meant like a headline. I should have put a full stop after the battle. And I've made senoritas singular possessive, capitalizing like a proper name. Maybe this was more than sloppiness and a hasty self-serving scrawl on a postcard. It was, in fact, true that I had no interest in the other girls, just in whatever it was that this particular senorita had inside her, Luisa Morales. Clyde takes a guess at where my mind has gone. Good thing we've got a copy desk, he says, a puff of his relit cigar floating past me. If I were you, I wouldn't trust a reporter who bothered to figure out apostrophes anyway, I say. But I'm not looking at him.
It's a lovely passage, Robert. I should tell our listeners, if they want to see the picture and indeed some of the other ones, they can find them on our website, which is at www.theconnection.org. That's www.theconnection.org. You have this guy as a reporter from the Tribune, mm-hmm. in a particular place at a particular time. Do you know that's who he was, or did you make it up?
No, I made that up, although I think I've made a pretty good guess about the place and time. The history of postcards is such that I could, looking at that card, I could place it somewhere in the 1907 to 1915 range. He's clearly a gringo, this guy, both by attitude and his look. And we see it's Mexico. It's very – and after the battle with an American there, it became quickly clear to me that this was, in fact – and that's an interesting thing about this book, Robin. Every story in here has remarkable resonance into the present day in terms of a wide range of the issues that are in our society. This one was a bit of military adventurism. Woodrow Wilson and America invaded Mexico in 1914, over a trifle, by the way, because we did not like the dictator who was running Mexico at the time, and we were concerned about American oil interests.
And yet what strikes me very much about all of these stories is how very firmly you anchor them in a particular place and a particular time. And I wonder how much of that is your imagination and how much of it is what I would call journalistic research.
There was certainly the particularities of the time. I was scrupulous about getting the time right. The little news stories that are interleaved between the stories are all absolutely true, real stories.
And all from one day.
Yes, all from that exact day, which was dictated by the final postcard that I was going to use in the book. And the synchronicities were remarkable because the day that was mentioned is the last story in the book is from a postcard of people standing up to their waist in a body of water, and 100 of them smiling up at the camera. And the only inscription is Sunday, August 7th, 1910. So that was the day I had to work with. And I researched and pulled newspaper items out from that day. And lo and behold, the New York Tribune of that day had an editorial about picture postcards, which is the first item in the
– You felt it was meant to be, did you?
Absolutely. But I could not have written this book without the internet. I mean, it would have taken me 10 years to write it, because I did draw on a lot of resources, the historic New York Times, which is available on the internet, for example, and a lot of other sources that the One in White, for instance. I found a memoir on the internet, an unpublished memoir of a man who was a photographer in Mexico during that period. And I found out, for example, and this is a real historical detail, that after the Marines captured the custom house in Veracruz, which was the crucial battle, the next day they went down and restaged the whole event for the Pathé newsreel cameras. And those newsreels went and played in movie theaters around the United States. And, you know, and it was always believed that that was an actual newsreel of the real event. And in fact, it was a restaging.
But what a paradox that you should say you couldn't have written these stories without the internet. And here you are basing them on a form of communication which has a permanence to it that our electronic communications don't.
You're right. And a lot of the postcard writing that was done, you can see the same impulse that drives people to exchange emails now drove people to exchange postcards. This was before the phone, and there were two or three mail deliveries every day, and people would write postcard after postcard to each other just across town, for example.
Do you think, though, that if you were somehow able to do what you did with these postcards 100 years from now with emails, supposing you could get your hands on them, would you find the same kind of inspiration?
Absolutely. The human emotion, the issues of that day and age in the social sphere, the underlying universal human longings that are reflected here, those things never change.
But you must have found, looking through all those old postcards, surely the overwhelming majority contained the most dreadful banalities, didn't they?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. This was a labor-intensive hobby, Robin. Mm. I probably had to read 600 of the most awful kind of banal cards to find these few that came out. And the fact that I've probably got 150 or 200 wonderful ones in my collection tells you how much reading I did.
Yeah, and you presumably had to look for something which somehow ignited a little spark in your own imagination. You thought, I can do something with this.
Absolutely. And I could have written, I could do 10 volumes. It was very difficult to choose the 15. And I balanced them across gender and across the range of social issues, but I could have reproduced this book 10 times over.
We're talking about correspondence, postcards, emails. Do we leave a trail behind us? Do you still send postcards? Do you still receive them? Or are your words all just consigned to a virtual ether world? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. My guest is Robert Olin Butler. I'm Robin Lustig. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Robin Lustig in for Dick Gordon. My guest this hour is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Robert Olin Butler, and we're talking about his new collection of short stories, Had a Good Time, Stories from American Postcards. Robert, you looked through all these hundreds of postcards. You looked at the words written on the back, most of them pretty dull, pretty mundane stuff. What made the ones that you chose different?
Well, there was, I guess, put it in a word, is subtext. That is, the sense that there was a lot of life going on beneath the surface, and they're pretty. When you look at the 15 in the book, for example, they're hard to resist hearing what's beneath. For example, one of the simplest is a postcard with on the front. It's a mass-produced card. It's not a real photo postcard, but it. a woman looking forlorn and the printed word heartbroken underneath it. But when you turn it over, it's addressed to a man in Attleboro, Massachusetts, and there's simply four words. There's no salutation, no close, just the four words, "We'll meet in death." And then your first thought is that, whoa, this is a tough breakup of a relationship. But then you look more closely at the address, and the guy is at the Attleboro Sanitarium. So he's dying of tuberculosis, and his loved one is writing to him, and their relationship is so complex that there's no salutation, no close, no "I love you, darling, I'll miss you," whatever. It's just "We'll meet in death." And the story immediately begins to work on me and, you know, in my own imagination when you see something like that, or Milton and his wooden leg. Or
but it's interesting, that one in particular, it was the address as much as the message which gave you the basis for the story.
Exactly. Yeah, there was. You look at all the little clues, and those, you know, if you examine those, the nuances of the ways in which people express themselves indirectly, and that's what's interesting to fiction writers, and that's why I'm a novelist and not a journalist or an essayist, because I love the indirection. I love the way in which the human soul is revealed indirectly in the way language is used, in the telling sense detail, in putting together the fragments of the quotidian that illuminate the universal.
You drew a distinction just then between mass-produced cards and what you called photo cards. Now, maybe you should spell that out for us, because they are two very different kind of image.
Yes, they are. And in fact, the one in white is what we call a real photo postcard. We, meaning the people who collect postcards, and they are literally real photos. That is, at the beginning of the 20th century, not only were postcards suddenly becoming very popular, but also the little Brownie cameras were for the first time letting everyday folks have a chance to take their own photographs. And it quickly became quite a fad for people to take a photograph of their own with their own camera and then print the photo in multiple copies on postcard backs.
It was kind of like the gizmo of its day.
It certainly was. It was high tech.
and so you look, some of them, obviously the ones that you chose were these kinds of ones, and the one we began the show with was one of those, a photograph taken either of or by the person who then sent the card. But others were not. They were bought in a store. They were mass produced.
Exactly. And that's the other devilish thing about this hobby, is that the great message could be written on the back of any kind of card. And so it wasn't like there was any, because the people who sell postcards and the collectors and so forth, they don't read the backs. And so they're all categorized by various topics, and any topic could have a fabulous back on it.
Let's take a call. Bernadette is on the line from East Greenwich in Rhode Island. Bernadette, do you send postcards? Do you still receive postcards?
Both, absolutely. I first started getting into it, I actually am from Australia, and growing up down there and on an island, you're sort of aware of a lot of the rest of the world, but it's all out there and far away. So I used to eagerly anticipate getting postcards from people, and the first time I travelled I bought scads of them, and then they'd decorate my office, so it was a reminder of other worlds, if you like. And I've been fortunate enough to live in a few different countries, and I found postcards are fantastic. They're portable, they're a brief reminder or a prompt, a visual prompt. They can be written anywhere. You don't have to sit down and agonise for ages and choose beautiful paper. You can just put a few lines. Particularly observations of the place that I might be living in or an incident that may have happened to me, I can put it down in a few lines and send it off to a friend.
So you do write more than having a lovely time, do you?
Oh, absolutely. It's amazing how much you can fit on a postcard if you need to.
And what about receiving postcards? Do you get postcards which are more than just a pretty picture of a place where a friend or a family member has been?
Sadly, no. Most of them tend to be having a great time, you know, wish you were here. Mm. However, it is lovely that I do hear from people and that they've taken the time to send me a picture of another place.
And that's the key.
It's a visual prompt,
it's a visual prompt, but also it's a sign that you're not forgotten.
Absolutely.
Robert, that even in 1910, 1912, must have been part of why people sent cards. You're not forgotten.
Oh, absolutely. And now people pick up the phone often to make mm-hmm. that little impromptu, I'm here, you're there connection. But the postcard was one of the primary modes, if not the primary mode, of doing that in back in the beginning of the 20th century. I think that's why there were more interesting cards back then, because if you did have – you were burdened with an emotion that you had to express impromptu. They put them on cards back then. And now I think we're more apt even to pick up the phone than – I don't know how – I'm trying to think. I'm not sure how many impromptu outbursts of emotion I've gotten by email yet. There's a lot of the kind of formalities go into email. I still think the phone is probably the primary medium for those little outbursts of emotion.
I want to go back to another one of your stories, because you were talking earlier about some parallels that you draw sometimes between the stories from the early part of the 20th century and more contemporary phenomena. This is one. It's a story just called Earl Sand, and it's a story woven around a photograph of the early aviator's plane just moments before it crashed, leading to his death. The words on the back are simply, "This is Earl Sand in his aeroplane just before it fell." Can you read us just a little bit of that one?
Sure. And this is in the voice of the guy who took that photo, and that's one of those real photo postcards. And he had his camera up there and watched this happen. A falling. He fell, Earl Sant. The aeroplane suddenly reared up on its left side as if it wanted to turn to the right, but the nose went down and there was so little sky below, so little. And then the aeroplane tried to lift itself, briefly, but the wing was tearing away and the engine hammered loud, and Earl Sant turned sharply to the right again, pointing to the earth, and his aeroplane looped, the engine crying out, and he fell, disappearing behind a stand of pine. There was a heavy thump beyond the trees, and I have nothing in my head to compare it to. Not a barn collapsing, not a horse going down, not the dead sugar maple, 40 foot high, I had felled only yesterday in our yard. The sound was new, and our silence followed. We all of us could not take this in. He had flown, this Earl Sant. He had raised his goggles to his eyes and stepped into his machine, and he had run along the meadow and had lifted into the air. And now I looked into the empty place where he had been only a moment before. In my head, I could see once again the two great wings and the spinning of the propeller, and then he was gone. Papa? It was my son's voice drifting up to me from the silence. I looked into his face. It's all right, I said, though I knew it was not. I could feel Matthew's bones beneath my hand, which still lay on his shoulder. He's gone, my son said. I looked to the others. There was a stirring. Some of the women began to cry. Mother of God, one man said, and he moved in the direction of the pines. He was right. We had to do something now.
There are a couple of lines in that, Robert, which give me a clue as to where you think the contemporary resonance of that might be. I have nothing in my head to compare it to. We all of us could not take this in. What was in your head as you wrote that?
You're absolutely right, Robin. Those are the two lines. This story was – I began this story at the end of October in 2001, and what had happened just 6 weeks earlier, I'm sure, influenced – not just how I saw this, but the choice of that card as a story to write. Because, in fact, it seems to me that the thing that is most profoundly abiding about our reaction to 9/11 has not so much to do with international terrorism and world politics and homeland security, although those are very important issues still. But the thing that really got us and that lingers with many of us is the fact that in seeing an airplane crash, as this guy did in, you know, back in the beginning of the 20th century, we saw an airplane crash in such a way as to get around the defenses that we usually have to protect us from confronting our own mortality. And that's what happened here. That's what happened in my story, and I think that's what happened in 9/11, is that each of us, one soul at a time, confronted our own mortality in a striking way that we had not been forced to before.
and that is not, in fact, the only linkage between this collection of stories and the events of 9/11. You had a story in a magazine, an in-flight magazine.
Absolutely. Let me tell you. Yeah, and your reminder of that just gave me chill bumps, because the first story I wrote in this book was a commission. It was a commission story from a magazine who was not did not normally do fiction, and that was simply the commission, write us a short story. And so I thought, well, this is a good chance to kick off the postcard book. So I chose a postcard, and I wrote the story, and it turned out really well, and they loved it, and they printed it in the magazine. Now, this was in – the commission came in March of 2001, and I delivered it in May, and they published it in the September issue. And the magazine was Hemispheres Magazine, which was the in-flight magazine of United Airlines. So the first story of Had a Good Time was in every seat back, on every seat, in the plane that flew into the South Tower and the one that went down in Pennsylvania.
It's an extraordinary, extraordinary congruity there. Let's talk to Constantine, who's on the line from Cambridge in Massachusetts. Constantine, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks. What do you think about postcards?
Well, I'm not sure how much my story fits in with what you were just speaking about, but just another. My great grandfather collected postcards. I'm originally from Greece, and for him it was really just purely a way to get pictures from around the world. So he would send out pictures of Greece, postcards, I mean, and then in return he would request pictures from whomever he was corresponding with, and in addition, he would ask for the address of someone else that this person knew. So, by this method, he amassed a fairly sizable collection of postcards from really all over the world, from places that he could hardly have hoped to ever have gone to himself.
But the key, presumably, for him was the pictures, was the images.
I think so. I mean, just having flipped through his collection, it doesn't seem like there's much more than just the pictures there. It doesn't seem like his actual correspondence amounts to anything more than just the pictures.
Can you remember the last time you got a postcard from anybody?
I actually try to exchange postcards fairly often. I guess often for me is less often than it was for him, but maybe a few times a year.
Okay. Robert, I want to come back to you.
One thing, Robin. In a way, in a sense, we may be underestimating the act of the impulse to and the act of legitimate connection and reaching out that just the sending of the card represents. Even if one isn't in command of one's unconscious and one's deepest feelings at the time of writing a card, the impulse to say even on what is on the surface a banal thing is in some ways not a banal act at all. It's that profound human impulse to connect to the other. And so even the most routine of cards, I think, carries with it the gesture of our humanity, the gesture of our desire to connect with each other.
But today, of course, we connect with each other by very different means. I mean, if I think about
Indeed. How
my kids stay in touch with me, the only time they would dream of sending a postcard is they couldn't get a signal on their cell phone.
That's absolutely true.
And of
Which
course,
is not uncommon.
I want to talk to you
at least the signal problems. Yeah.
Well, absolutely. I want to talk to you about language, if I may, for a second, because one of the things you do in these stories is you find the voice of the person through whose eyes you tell the story. And they are very different voices. They are men, they are women, they are young, they are old, they are white, they are black, they're from all different regions of the country. Now, how do you do that?
Well, it's not a technical trick. If you look at – this is my 13th book, and the book that I won the Pulitzer for was a book of short stories called A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain, and that was written in the voices of 15 different Vietnamese expatriates living in southern Louisiana, and the range of voices was quite wide there. I've written in the voices – my last novel, Fair Warning, was in the voice of a 40-year-old brilliant young woman who was in the upscale world of auctioneering in New York City, and I've written in the voice of literally a spaceman, and I wrote stories in the voice of I did a book of stories from the headlines in tabloid newspapers. I wrote a story called "Jealous Husband Returns in Form of Parrot." So I've written the voices of parrots before. I'm enchanted with the human voice and the ways in which the voice reveals the inner life, and that's the way I write. And as a result, every book I write, every story I write, is in a way unexpected. I do not continue to do the same things over again because whatever gift I have as a writer is really focused on the ways in which the voices of humanity speak in their own individual ways, and yet all of them revealing at their deepest level the common universal yearnings for a self, for an identity, for a place in the universe, for connection to the other.
I have the impression when I read your stories that you actually hear the sound of the voice as you write the words. Is that right?
I think in some real sense that's correct. And at times it almost feels like channeling. There is a voice that comes into my consciousness and in that kind of trance state that I get into to write, and it does kind of speak through me. My early training was as an actor,
uh-huh.
And method acting, and the way of making your own inner sensory mechanism come into concert with the inner sensory mechanisms of the character you're creating. So taking on a role has been part of my process even before I started writing.
That's interesting. American history through postcards is what we're talking about this hour. Is there a risk that we could lose the art of correspondence as we go for the email and the text message and forget how to write on the back of a postcard? What do you think? 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My guest is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author, Robert Olin Butler. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection. This hour we're talking about the art of the American postcard and the lasting quality of some of the early 20th century cards and what was written on them. Our guest is the author Robert Olin Butler, who's published a collection of short stories based on the messages on postcards. It's called Had a Good Time, Stories from American Postcards. Robert, some of the cards that you chose to base your stories on don't have stamps on them, don't have postmarks on them. Were they actually sent?
Yes, they were. And what happened was they were commonly didn't just put into an envelope and addressed and sent. Some of the, because of course these little outpourings of emotion and some are quite revealing and for the time even quite shocking in some ways. As a matter of fact, I'm surprised as many put stamp on those kinds of cards as did, because the postman was apt to read those, and everybody at the post office. And in small town America at the beginning of the 20th century, that would have left you quite vulnerable. So often they would just write the message on the back of the postcard and then put it in an envelope and stamp that and mail it.
Okay, I'm just looking at one now, in fact, which does not have a stamp or a postmark on it. It's the one, the story is called Carl and I, and the message on the card just reads, "Dearest sweetheart, a line or two, hoping they will find you all in good health. As for me, I am getting worse. I don't think I will live long enough to see your dear face again." Not a message I guess you'd want the mailman to see necessarily.
Exactly.
Let's talk to Beth, who's on the line from Meadows of Dan in Virginia. Beth, hello.
Hello.
Do you use postcards?
Oh, I use them all the time. In fact, I am a postcard collector as well as a dealer, and I happen to be a dealer who reads every back.
Ah, you like the words too.
You're a rarity, Beth.
I realize that.
Now, you deal in postcards.
Yes.
You buy and you sell.
Yes.
What do you choose them for?
Well, I obviously, you know, do choose the postcards that I think people will buy of the scenes, especially of their hometowns. But I also do focus on the backs, especially I'm always interested in the racist statements. There's quite a few. But I'm also interested in the romantic ones.
Do you have any right there? Is there anyone particularly in your mind at the moment?
Well, yes. Actually, I have a collection of about 20 postcards that a fella named Edwin sent to a woman named Nellie back around 1912. And he would draw pictures on them. I mean, they were just wonderful. I mean, I would have married the man tomorrow if I was getting these postcards.
Have you been tempted to do what Robert clearly has done, which is try to imagine the story, the life, the people who are behind those cards that you have there?
Oh, absolutely. With Edwin and Nellie, I had bought this collection of postcards from an auction, and I mean, I had them married with children and everything, and then I found a postcard from about 1922 from Nellie and Robert when they were on vacation. So I immediately had to invent the fact that Edwin must have died in World War I.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't let him go.
You may very well be right. Thanks very much for that, Beth.
Okay.
Let's move to line two. Louise from Raleigh, North Carolina, is on the line. Louise, how about you?
I'm fine, thank you. And so excited about this program. I've been looking forward to it since I first heard it announced, and so I plan my day around listening to The Connection.
You're a postcard lover, obviously.
Well, it's not so much that I'm a postcard lover, but that I relate so much to Robert Olin Butler in weaving the stories from the postcards, because we have a collection of postcards that were exchanged between my husband's grandmother and her family members.
Uh-huh.
And we did not know these family members except from the oral history that would be related to us, because they were all dead by the time my husband and I were married. But by reading these postcards and seeing the choice of pictures on the postcards, we can sort of weave a little bit of a family history for our children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren.
So you can do that, and you believe that what you can weave is factual. You're not using your imagination to think what might have happened, what they might have been like.
Well, a little of both, because I don't know it to be factual, but I knew some of the family members. I knew my husband's grandmother and his mother, and of course I know my husband after 55 years, but it seems that you can see a family trait running through the messages, because they were always relating to each other, how other family members were and what was happening in their lives. And it was their way of keeping in touch with each other, although they lived several miles apart.
Mm.
And then the fact that they chose very comical picture postcards. In fact, there's one of the old-fashioned cameras taking a picture of a young lady and a raunchy-looking man here, and she's lifting her long skirt to show her garter, and the comment on the front of the card is, "What a snap."
Louise, thank you so much. From North Carolina to South Carolina, David's on the line from Charleston. David, hello.
Hello.
How about you and postcards?
What we usually do is when we have two small kids and we travel quite a bit, and what we'll do is we send postcards to their class. And that way, kind of, you know, while the kids are out of class for that week or whatever, they can, you know, send a postcard and kind of be excited, too, when they get back and see the postcard hanging on the bulletin board in their class.
And how do you choose which postcard to send?
Usually something that's an interesting, you know, picture, something that may be a little unusual, something that kids would get a kick out of,
mm-hmm.
you know, to kind of strike their interest. And we also will usually send a postcard to ourselves, so that, and usually we get home before we get the postcard, and then it comes in the mail, you know, several days later, which is kind of a, you know, after the fact,
yep.
kind of you know, nice to see that postcard, and we hang it up on our fridge at home, and you know, the kids get a kick out of that, too.
Okay, thanks. Robert, it's interesting. It would appear, at least from people who are listening to the show, that more people than you might have expected are still sending postcards.
Indeed. Well, it's still a fairly common thing, I guess. And certainly, collecting postcards is the third largest collectible in the world after stamps and coins. Hmm. By the way, interesting that Beth's mentioning the little run of cards. Hmm. The runs are really interesting because these cards tend to get dumped into antique malls. As whole out of estate sales where the descendants of these people have lost interest or passed away themselves, and these cards just are abandoned into the world. And there was one run of about a dozen cards that I had. There were 12 cards, all to one man, and they were from – and he seemed to be a traveling salesman. They were all over a two-year period, and they all came from four contiguous states. And they were – the 12 cards were from 9 different women – and all 9 women spoke to him as if they were engaged to him. In fact, one of them said, "You understand that now that we've done what we've done, we are like husband and wife forever." So this is the other side of these series. But
why did you leave those out?
Well, I couldn't get them all. You know, it's 9 cards or 12 cards. I've told you, there's plenty of material for more books here. But the interesting thing, if you think about it, is that this guy saved all of those cards till the day he died.
Hmm.
They were, you know, he kept them all until the very day he died, which is that spins the message into an interesting place.
It does. I want to ask you a question about your imagination, because several of the stories in this collection relate to or touch upon death. Some of them in a rather unexpected way. You've already described the very last picture, the very last story in the collection. The picture is of, you've described it, a group of people in the water, 100 or more of them, obviously having a wonderful time. On the back of the card, simply the date, Sunday, August the 7th, 1910. And the story that you weave from this is of a man who dies of a heart attack on the beach. How do you get from a happy picture of 100 people having a good time to a man dying of a heart attack?
That's an interesting question. I almost didn't know it myself. I put him on the beach, and he's reading the newspaper. All the newspaper items that have been interwoven between the stories through the book. That sort of motif of the news item was going to come to fruition here, in his reading the New York Times on the beach there, and honestly, this sounds odd, but the process is: I understand the character, I understand what the character's yearning for, and I begin to write, and the character then reveals, the story reveals itself, And indeed, he does not recognize it, even to the end, what's going on. But we do, that he's in the midst of having a heart attack.
Do you have a morbid streak?
No, but I honestly think that was probably the accumulation of the early 20th century. There was a high mortality rate. It was before antibiotics or even sulfa drugs there was a very there was the great influenza epidemic in the world in the teens, where 20 million people died worldwide, and tuberculosis was a constant threat, and they even referred for children to the second summer when a very high percentage of children died. Death was ever present, and it is with us today too, and more so at the beginning of the 21st century than ever, with AIDS and with the sense that that somebody can strap on a bomb and walk into a nightclub and kill you, or a plane can fly in your window piloted by a man with the vision of 72 virgins dancing in his head. I mean, the world is a terribly dangerous place now, or it has. But the fact is, it has always been, and so life and death intermingle in these stories, and there are hopeful stories, and even his passing, the last vision of his mother, finally letting her hair down, there is a kind of many of the deaths come with great grace, but it was a dangerous time and still is.
But there is an extraordinary sadness about the very last words in your book, which are a news item, one which I take it you in fact invented, death at Coney, relating to the story that you have just written. Amidst the revelry yesterday at Coney Island, a man quietly died on the beach. Harold Smith, 48 years old, an office manager of 173 Lutley Street, Manhattan, was found dead in a canvas chair of apparent natural causes. His demise went unnoticed for some time, in spite of being surrounded by Coney's largest crowd of the season. A lonely, unnoticed death, the very last words in your collection. It's a sad That's note true. To end on.
It is, although but there was a crowd celebrating around him. And that's the thing. In the midst of life, we are in the midst of death. And they intimately embrace. And it's not a simple thing to our joys in this world, but neither are the tragedies simple.
Robert, what's the most memorable postcard you've received?
Personally?
Mm-hmm.
Boy, that's an interesting question.
I was just wondering if there was a postcard that you once received which got you thinking about what they do and what they mean. In fact, it would seem it's the collection that set you off.
That's a fascinating question, Robin. But you know something, upon recollection and reflection, there is not a single card that came out. I know I sent a lot of great cards, but I don't remember receiving very many of them when I was in Vietnam.
Well, when we come off air, the team here are going to put their heads together and see if we can send you a memorable postcard.
I would love that, Robin.
Now, do you send postcards, Robert?
I still do occasionally, but you know something, Robin, I tend to write emails.
That's a very sad admission coming from you.
The saddest thing of all, isn't it?
Robert Olin Butler, it has been a huge pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us on The Connection. The Nobel Prize winning author, Robert Olin Butler, who's written a wonderful collection of short stories called Had a Good Time, Stories from American Postcards. And if you'd like to see some of the cards from that collection, or indeed to see him composing one of his stories online, go to our website, www.theconnection.org. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection.